not produce more than 5,000 degrees, and would that just be because that energy is radiated out more quickly if it does seem like you would reach 5,000 degrees? Does that somehow mean that the reaction pushing energy out, releasing energy, would be slowed down? AC2IS.
In the case of a magnifying glass where I'm creating a hot spot to try to burn a hole in my newspaper, for instance, the source of the energy is the surface of the sun. It's radiant energy, optical energy from the source of the sun. That's what your magnifying glass is working on. Your magnifying glass is not going to pass much of the infrared, not going to pass much of the ultraviolet. So it's the optical frequencies, and optically speaking, the surface of the sun is around 5,000 degrees. So you can't get more than 5,000 or 5,500, whatever the number is, in your hotspot. In the case of a nuclear reaction that's not focusing solar energy, it's got nothing to do with the 5,000 degrees of the sun. Depending on how skilled you are in your focusing devices inside of your nuclear device and how big your source of energy is, is this a 10 kiloton bomb or is it a 10 megaton bomb? And in that case, the word temperature has got some very different meanings. You've got some so-called Compton electrons, or you've got some extremely high power, extremely high velocity neutrons, protons, and all kinds of things flying out of that nuclear reaction at the instant of detonation. And now those particles and that gamma ray energy and everything else hitting local surfaces, is there a limit to the temperature they can go to? Probably not. That nuclear reaction at the first microsecond, let me drop it. If somebody told me that the first microsecond of this 10 megaton thermonuclear hydrogen bomb, if somebody told me that he's got the right kind of instrumentation and he measured 10 million degrees centigrade, it is my belief, Bill, that that number would be well within the laws of possibility. You've got this huge amount of energy coming out of there in a hurry. Nuclear power is just something else compared to normal experience of mankind. Cannot exceed a high temperature, oh boy. And if it's 50 million degrees, easily. A lightning bolt also, the center of the plasma field in a lightning bolt also hits numbers that are considerably hotter than the surface of the sun. In some cases, they claim that for the first microsecond, it can be hotter than the core of the sun. Over to you, Bill, K2IW. AG2IS, K2IW.
Okay, thank you for that answer. AC2IS.
You got it, John.
AG2WGB. Okay, this gentleman's asking a question, and it's about capacitors. He has some spray capacitors, you know, the orange drop type, and he needs a 0.05, but he needs it at 2,000 volts. So what he wants to do is put two 0.1s in series so he can get that voltage. Now, he wants to know what you think of that, and the next question is, do you think the encapsulation will hold that voltage, or do you think it will arc to the chassis? He cannot find that value at 2,000 volts, so if you could help him out with something on that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
So let's assume now that he's got to withstand 2 kilovolts. Let's assume that the rating of each capacitor is 1 kilovolt or more. And simply putting the two in series is the beginning of a solution. However, each individual capacitor, let's assume this is a DC circuit, excuse me for simplicity, 2,000 volts DC. If each of those capacitors had the absolutely identical leakage resistance, internal resistance, that appears to be across the plates, and if it was absolutely identical, that would work. But let's get real. For all we know, the leakage resistance on one of those capacitors is 1 million ohms. Very good number. Let's assume that the leakage resistance of the other capacitor is 10 million ohms. Even better number. Because the second capacitor is so much better, because its internal leakage resistance is such a higher number, when you put the two in series, 90% of the 2 kilovolts, when it settles down, is going to appear across the second capacitor, and the first capacitor transmitter is only going to have 10% of the voltage. So you're going to exceed the limit daylight out of the voltage rating of those two capacitors, one of them, because they're not thoroughly balanced in every way. Therefore, let me drop. There are lots of situations when ham radio operators will put a number of capacitors in parallel. That's easy. In series, to get higher voltage, you got a problem. Whenever you put capacitors in series, you almost always have to put a network of dividing resistors. If you know that the lowest possible leakage resistance of these capacitors is 1 million ohms, and you want to make sure that they really divide the voltage equally between the two, you've got to choose a leakage resistor that's small compared to the 1 million ohms. Maybe it's 100 kilo ohms. So if you put a 100 kilo ohm resistor across each capacitor, and now you put the two capacitors with those resistors in series, you now have a near, really guaranteed equal divider network. The high voltage is going to appear equally across the two capacitors. The next problem is, can your circuit with 100 kilo ohm, 100 kilo ohms and 1,000 volts, let me think of what's that current, 1,000 volts and 100 kilo ohms, we got to calculate how much power is being dissipated by that resistor. And so you got to work about that. You got to worry about that. Choose the right resistor, and hopefully your circuit can tolerate an extra leakage resistance. And maybe the answer is you better test each of the capacitors you're going to use and make sure that your individual capacitors have a leakage resistance. Let me drop it. Make sure that each one has a leakage resistance of 10 megohms. And now you put a now you have the ability to put a 1 megohm resistor across each one to make sure that they divide the voltage equally. And 1 megohm at 1,000 volts, I think, is 1 milliampere. And so that's a rather controlled amount of current. 1 milliampere, though, at 1,000 volts is 1 watt of dissipation, if I got it right. So each one of those resistors in this example, 1 megohm equalizing resistors, when the leakage in the capacitors is 10 megohms, each resistor is going to dissipate 1 watt. And as long as you make sure those are 2-watt resistors, you got it made. So, capacitors in series, at first they look good. Lots of people forget about the fact Murphy's Law dictates they are never going to have the identical leakage resistance. Something similar happens whenever you put individual batteries in series. You assume that each battery has the identical amount of energy storage and the identical amount of leakage resistance inside. And now you put it on the shelf for a month, and the leakage resistance of one dissipates at a lot faster than the other, and these two batteries in series are not going to give you quite the performance you think. One of them is going to go dead sooner, and when it goes dead, the other one that's still cranking is now going to be putting reverse voltage on the remaining battery. And in some batteries, like Nikkeds, for instance, you put reverse voltage on them, and they really get unhappy. They start growing dendrites, and eventually become a dead short circuit across the plates. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. By the way, a similar thing happens when you put diodes in series. If I'm building a 3,000 volt power supply, and I've only, which means I'm going to have at least 7 or 8,000 volts of peak inverse voltage on that rectifying diode on the back half of the cycle. And now I can't buy diodes of 7,000 volt peak inverse voltage rating, let's say. I can only buy 1,000 volt diodes. And so I think I'm going to put 7 of them in series. On paper, at first, that looks good. You better put some dividing resistors and dividing capacitors across those 7 diodes to make sure they share the voltage. And the reason you're doing the resistors is to make sure whatever the leakage resistance, the back leakage resistance of those diodes is, make sure they share that peak inverse voltage. You're putting capacitors there because some diodes look identical, but one diode may have twice the internal capacitance of the other. Therefore, on the AC cycle, again, even though they got identical leakage resistance, during the dynamic situation of an AC voltage, they may not be sharing the voltage. So whenever you put diodes in series, if you're doing a belt and suspenders engineering operation, let me drop. Whenever you put diodes in series, you're going to put equalizing resistors and equalizing capacitors if you want that power supply to survive. Go ahead, Bill. AC2IS or AG2IS, whatever it is. K2IW, you got it, Bill.
Yeah, this is AC2IS, Bill. So,
for batteries in series, there's a partial solution, I guess, for nickel metal hydride batteries, where if you overcharge the string of batteries in series, the nickel metal hydrides, when they reach their full capacity, will start sort of discharging internally, allowing a charge that is allowing a charge to be built up on a battery that went lower than the rest of them. I don't know if I said that clearly enough. And then on diodes, I know in parallel, suggestion maybe is to use Schottky diodes, where I guess if you're putting a higher current through them, the cross diode increases slightly, so that loads will not all go onto one diode and avoid the other. And I'm wondering if that helps at all when you put them in series, AC to IS.
When you're charging a set of NiCads, for instance, which have multiple cells in series, because there is a rating for NiCads, where as long as you're below some particular current number, I think it's 0.1C, if your particular batteries are good for 1 ampere hour, and you're charging them at the rate of 0.1C, in other words, 100 milliamps, as long as your charging current is 100 milliamps or less, you're allowed to overcharge those batteries for a long period of time without creating excessive heating. As long as you're using that number, then if you wait long enough, they will all come up to full charge, even though some of them will partially discharge, because the ones that fully charge will just sit there doing nothing because you're not exceeding their current rating, and the one that's not yet fully charged will then come up to full charge. That's one approach. However, because we're not willing to wait that long, almost all of the batteries being used on battery-powered radio-controlled model airplanes these days, there's a wire coming off each individual cell. And the sophisticated charger those guys are using these days, the sophisticated charger with all of those wires coming off each cell, measures the voltage on each individual cell. And the sophisticated power supply rapidly charges that whole battery pack, keeping track of the exact voltage on each cell. Let me drop. And on the individual cells that are not fully charged, obvious by the fact they didn't come up to the full voltage, that sophisticated power supply will put extra current into that particular cell compared to all the others, even though they're all in series. So there's a whole bunch of parallel wires going into that sensing circuit of that sophisticated charger. And therefore, these RC guys are able to do very rapid charging in a very safe manner, as long as all that monitoring is taking place. Now, when it comes to putting diodes in series, I'm going to discuss them first. Putting these dividing resistors and dividing capacitors across each of the diodes is strongly recommended. When you're putting diodes in parallel, because you want to share the current and you can't get a high enough current rating in any one diode, let me drop it. You must put a series resistor series with each of those diodes before you put them in parallel. That's the only way you can be sure they come very close to sharing the current. Because even if you've got an identical pair of diodes, and you think you can put them in parallel, each one has a voltage rating where they start drawing current at exactly 4/10 of a volt, 3/10 of a volt for these Schottky diodes. You think they're completely balanced. You can easily get a runaway condition where, for whatever reason, one of the diodes gets a little bit hotter than the other. The hotter Schottky diode has now a lower working voltage. The lower working voltage when they're in parallel means that he starts sharing more of the current. He starts absorbing more of the current, which makes him hotter. Therefore, you've got a runaway condition. So putting diodes in parallel without equalizing series resistors on each individual diode is dangerous. You can get that runaway condition. I think you see what can go on there, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW in the deck net.
I guess I see what you're saying, but is it not correct then that Schottky diodes have the characteristic where their resistance increases slightly along with current and then would work without these series? AC2IS.
And the words I use maybe is appropriate for silicon or germanium diodes. In the case of Schottky, if you're positive, that the striking voltage of a Schottky diode goes up with hot, with heat, then yes, they would automatically share the current, and it sounds like a safe way to go. See, I think you've got to read the specs very carefully on the diodes. What is the change in diode voltage in the forward conducting mode as a function of temperature? As long as that voltage goes up with higher temperature, I agree with you. Back to you, Bill, K2RIW.
This would be the voltage drop across the diode with current, not necessarily with temperature. And if the application was in power supplies, where I saw Schottky diodes specified, so that you could gang them up in parallel, currents you're looking for. Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, if you're using those diodes in such a way that they're going to be conducting 50 amperes, for instance, and you've got two in parallel, what you care about is that when 25 amperes is flowing through each diode, because a pair of them in parallel, and you're trying to get to 50, at the 25 ampere current, are they reasonably matched in voltage drop? Are they reasonably matched in voltage drop as a function of temperature? And is that voltage drop versus temperature a positive coefficient, not a negative? So if at the 25 ampere rating, in my example, at 25 ampere of forward current, if the voltage drop, which used to be 5 tenths, goes to 6 tenths, when you go from 25 degrees C to 50 degrees C, then I think you've got it made. As long as the voltage increases with higher temperature, I think you can safely put them in parallel, as long as they start off close enough. If for some reason, due to manufacture differences, if one of them at the 25 ampere rating has got 5 tenths of a volt drop, and the other one's got 8 tenths of a volt drop at 25 amperes, even though they might be beautifully matched at 1 ampere, again, you could have an unbalance that maybe you've got to consider. So what is the statistical distribution of voltage drop at your current rating? Over to you, Bill, K2RIW.
I'm sure I'm not going to be able to crowd Schottky diodes off the top of my head. I'll bow out of this conversation. ACYS.
Bill, in theory, that information is on the data sheet. If you go to a good manufacturer, they give you 4 or 5 pages of reverse recovery time, forward voltage drop, thermal characteristics, leakage resistance, reverse capacitance, reverse apparent capacitance versus voltage. There's graph after graph after graph if you go to a good manufacturer. There's a lot of data there. So what you and I are now talking about, there's a good chance it exists on the data sheet of a quality-made Schottky diode. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go with the next one, John.
KC2WGB. Well, we have to complete all his questions. We forgot one of his questions. His last question was, do you think the encapsulating element that's around the capacitors will withstand the 2,000 volts when they're only rated for 1,000 volts? He's worried about it arcing to other components through that plastic coating, or maybe to the chassis. What do you think you should do about that? Or do you think it's nothing to worry about?
If each individual capacitor is truly rated to 1,000 volts, and if the manufacturer is doing a good job, then yes, that capacitor with its outer plastic or ceramic or whatever it is coating can in theory sit up against the chassis with 1,000 volts without arcing over. That doesn't mean you can push it to 2,000 volts. No way. Therefore, when you're putting 2,000 volts on that upper capacitor, it better have a certain predictable amount of distance to the chassis. Since air has a dielectric strength of roughly 30,000 volts per centimeter, it tells you the absolute minimum distance you better have between that capacitor and any other grounded surface. However, you've got to worry about something else. Is this piece of electronics going to fly in an airplane? The 30,000 volts per centimeter of dielectric strength of air is a beautiful number at sea level. You go to 30,000 feet, and that number changes by about 3 or 4 to 1. You don't get 30,000 volts per centimeter, you'd be lucky to get 10,000 volts per centimeter. Air at a higher altitude with lower pressure has a much lower dielectric strength. It arcs over at a much lower voltage. So you better carefully choose the spacing between that capacitor and the chassis. That's one approach. Let me drop. Because you and I have such extremely high faith in the dielectric strength of a sheet of Teflon. Be careful now. It's got to be virgin Teflon. Recycled Teflon has pinholes. So if it's virgin Teflon sheet, and you got the right thickness of sheet of Teflon, and you wrap it around that capacitor, you've now made the case of that capacitor have a much higher dielectric strength as far as arcing over to a chassis is concerned. That's just one of a number of solutions. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I agree, Dick. Well, I would recommend some heat shrink tubing or maybe just some spaghetti, which should be sufficient. Because they're small enough capacitors, those Lalonde drops, you might be able to do that. All right. Well, I think he's well on his way with that. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the last end. Okay. This young scientist here has a question about the space travel that we talk about an awful lot when Paul and you and I are discussing this. He's reading about suspended animation. Do you think it will ever be used for travel? Because he understands that when somebody's in suspended animation, we have to keep some of the metabolic rates going. His heart has to work. His brain has to get circulating oxygen in the blood. So we'd like to hear your impression on do you think it'll ever be used, and do you really think it's possible to do it? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
There have been medical conditions where a person has a certain condition where the physicians must buy themselves some time. And so they will, in a controlled manner, lower the person's body temperature, put them to sleep, and instead of 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, you lower them to, I don't know what the number is, maybe it's 68 degrees Fahrenheit. There's some specific number where if it's done correctly, you can lower a body, the person is unconscious, but in theory, none of the organs are experiencing any damage. However, I worry about this one. In the case of a very serious medical condition, like cancer or a heavy wound that has to heal and so on, it may be the least destructive thing to do. It may be desirable. But I worry about the fact that many of these techniques could affect the brain, where long-term memory, short-term memory, certain brain functions could be partially damaged. Of all the people that I've ever interviewed, let me drop it. Of all the people I have ever interviewed that have undergone triple or quadruple bypass operations, coronary bypass operations, where the operation itself takes a large number of hours, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe it's 8 hours. So for 8 solid hours, the guy's heart has been stopped. They're in there sewing things and doing all kinds of procedures. And he's on a heart-lung machine, which is trying to pump his heart as efficiently as the heart-lung machine is trying to pump the blood as if it was his heart. And another portion of the machine is trying to act like his lungs. And so whenever we use a machine to duplicate those body components, you have only partial success. The exact pulse waveform coming out of a human heart has a very specific function to it. You want to make sure that it's a real pulse, not too strong, not too weak. And the way your lungs do oxygenation, there's some very specific, careful chemical balances, whatever, that are required. This artificial heart-lung machine does that function partially. Let me drop quick. It does it with the best technology we've got today. But you carefully interview anybody who's gone under that triple or quadruple bypass operation. If the person is being honest, a high percentage of those people will say, I sense the fact that I don't think the same way after that operation. I've lost some of my memory. I don't think quite as fast. I don't feel quite as smart as I used to. I've lost something in the process. A significant percentage of the people undergoing that operation will say those words. Is it psychosomatic or real? I have seen evidence with a good friend of mine where I think it is real. So you pay a price. No free lunch here, if you know what I mean. So that's a kind of very controlled, very short-range, 8-hour suspended operation, suspended animation. And it is slightly damaging from my point of view. So until we make a lot of progress, are we going to put human beings into very long suspended animation? Let me drop. And then a year later or a decade later, you're going to revive them, and you think they're going to come back to 100% performance. I'm worried about that, and now you know the nature of my worry. And how in the world do you test for this? I mean, if a person's IQ went down by 5 points because of that procedure, would you be happy with that? I don't know. Not everybody will answer that. Somebody got a further comment on this? Give us your call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. This is John, KD2IXP. This is something I know a little bit about for a couple of reasons. First of all, I worked for the New York City Emergency Medical Service for a very long time. Second of all, I have a mechanical heart. I have an LVAD, and so I am aware of what's involved in extended periods of stopping a person's heart. In every instance, there is some brain function that's lost due to hypoxia, due to lack of oxygen. Let me drop it. Different protocols for hypothermic treatment for patients who have been severely injured or have a disease process. It used to be to cool the body, down below the 98.6, to cool it down to 92, 90, even in the 80s. The current literature on that shows that it's not effective, and it actually can be damaging. So hypothermia is being abandoned for those reasons. It was a good idea to invoke something called the mammalian diving reflex. That's where you hear about these people who've been submerged in water for an hour or an hour and a half and then come back with CPR and with, you know, advanced life support intervention. But it just doesn't work in most cases.
Yeah, I thank you for that information, John. You're confirming my suspicion. And there are people nowadays who will pay a large number of dollars to an organization that will take their body when they die, cryogenically cool it, and they think they're going to come back 10, 100,000 years from now, that somebody's going to thaw out this human being and hope that the freezing process, the cryogenic freezing process, did not create permanent brain damage and you're going to come back to life. I think there's an awful lot of excess faith in that belief. I'm having an awful lot of trouble that you're going to bring that person back as a human being, because unless you're putting some very fancy chemistry, and I don't know how the hell you would synthesize that chemistry, unless you put some very fancy chemistry in that blood supply, you take any of the water content that's in blood and you freeze it cryogenically, where water expands when it freezes, it's going to be doing damage to very fine capillaries in the brain, among other places. I guarantee that that's awfully destructive. So to thermally cool or cryogenically cool and then revive as a kind of suspended animation, good science fiction, I think we got a long way before we go there. And for the reasons I just given you, let me drop that. When a person is being offered a bypass operation, coronary bypass, I, for one, would ask for a second opinion before going through it. Was it really necessary? Is there any other intervention that can be used? If the amount of blockage you've got is not above a certain critical number, you then use a controlled lifestyle beyond that point, where the body will eventually form parallel blood flow techniques around the partial blockage if you properly correct your lifestyle. So you're no longer collecting those blockages. And by the way, an awful lot of those blockages, it is my belief. Now here you're hearing a belief. I don't have a great deal of scientific evidence to back it up. My particular family happens to have what I call mature onset sodium sensitivity. That's a fancy way of saying that when members of my family get beyond roughly 40 years of age, if they have a high salt diet, their heart periodically goes into a fibrillation. It starts skipping beats. At first, that doesn't sound dangerous. When one of those chambers of your heart skips a beat, and that chamber overfills, and the next heartbeat comes along, it's a super strong heartbeat. And when that super strong pressure wave comes out of that heart, it does damage to the nearby arteries. Let me drop. Those nearby arteries become damaged in such a way that they develop cracks and whatever on the inner surface. The body repairs those cracks, attempts to repair them, by applying something called cholesterol to them. So the cholesterol that you see, in some cases, in an artery, it is my belief, the body is attempting to do a repair procedure. But what was the cause of it in the first place? In my particular case, when members of my family start going on a low-salt diet, the palpitations disappear. That's just the way my family history behaves. And so, to stop the cholesterol from building up in the arteries that are being damaged by palpitations, and you can stop the palpitations by a fairly simple procedure, in my family's case, that's a hell of a lot better than for members of my family to go into what they call CABG, coronary bypass operations. And so, that's an opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with it. I understand that. So, as you can tell, when you start doing a lot of... Let me drop. Arguably one of the most complicated mechanisms on planet Earth is the human body and its brain. And if you start doing heavy intervention to it, like attempting suspended animation, like long-term exposure to a heart-lung machine, like putting in heart pacers when maybe the heart pacer was really not required. The person needs a heart pacer because he has something wrong with his body chemistry that's affecting the timing of his heart, similar to what my family experienced with salt exposure, sodium exposure. Another point I was going to make along these lines. So there's ways of correcting the original causes of action as opposed to putting in a pacer. And there are people who get disturbed heart rhythm, which in some cases is being created by high saline diet. And now these people are also getting defibrillators installed, heart pacers installed, which had they controlled the original causative agent, maybe they didn't need that heart pacer. All of these interventions, like doing a cardiac oblation, they try to burn out certain nodes of the timing mechanism of the heart in order to try to stop the timing irregularities. And in some cases, the timing irregularity, I believe, can be created by improper diet. So to take a pill to correct a condition, to put in machines to correct a condition, which are correctable by more natural means, I think there's a better way in some cases. That's an opinion. I know not everybody's going to agree with it. So you can sort of see what I feel. Good science fiction suspended operation, suspended animation, I don't believe it yet, though, John. But maybe I'm overly negative. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, you know, I think you're right, because bypass surgery is not being done as much right now that I'm aware of, because first they tried the angioplasty, which didn't work well, but now with the stents, they seem to be quite successful with that rather than trying to replace those arteries. So they're still doing some, I guess, in severe cases, but maybe you're right. Maybe that's why the stents have become more the fashion. And now to put those in, they can put them in right through your wrist. They go up with that wire. Amazing stuff. Okay, that's it from the mailbag. And I want to thank everybody for the questions and comments. And we'll go over to Paul and see what's happening in the space world. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
My first question, Paul, to the S2N, our space expert. what is Voyager saying today? And by the way, by way of that website that you and I discovered that was brought to our attention recently, why can't I think of the guy who brought it to our attention? Was it AT2IS? No. Was it Roy? AT2G? Yes. Anyhow, somebody brought to our attention a beautiful NASA website where you can go to each one of these deep space network dishes, all the 240-foot dishes and all the 85-foot dishes, and you can find out exactly what it's doing today. Which spacecraft is it talking to? What angle is it aimed at? How much power is the uplink? What data is being transmitted? What frequency is the uplink? Let me drop it.
Thought it was mic one. Mic number two.
There you go. Yes, it was mic number two. Yep, absolutely. You got a better memory than I do. So good old K1MJM, mic number two, brought that to our attention. Beautiful website. So now you know downlink power, downlink signal strength, and so on. Since they also were telling you round-trip time, you can calculate exact range, knowing what the speed of light is in free space. So I know the range. I can calculate the free space laws. I know roughly how many micro watts are being received, the dish, what diameter, therefore I know the gain of the dish. I can calculate, therefore, how much power is coming out of a spacecraft right now. I'm going to recheck that number, but I think I'm going to rediscover that Voyager is putting out something like 6 watts. It is a 6-watt QRP transmitter at 8 gigahertz, roughly 12 billion miles away, 37-hour round-trip time. So by way of that website, you and I have the ability. Let me drop it. I want you to know the dish size on the spacecraft, which is 12 foot in the case of Voyager. What's the dish size on the ground? 240 feet in the case of the Deep Space Network, Goldstone, for instance, or the one in Madrid, Spain, or the one in Canberra, Australia. And how much power are they receiving right now? You know, numbers like minus 140 dBm. That's a weak signal. Minus 150 dBm, numbers like that. So we can calculate how many watts is coming out of that spacecraft. That's the one thing they don't tell you. They tell you what they see on the ground, all the parameters they see on the ground. And we now have the ability to calculate what the spacecraft is doing. And sometimes, here we are 37 years downrange on a nuclear power supply that was rated for 5 or 10 years, and we're in our 37th year of using it, and this thing is still on the air, and they have good intention to talk to it at least until the year 2022. That's a piece of hardware. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. Those guys are serious.
This is WS2N. Dick, the Voyager 1. Of course, it doesn't seem like much of a change from week to week, but from year to year, it's quite a bit. I think every year it's roughly 3.5 AU difference, astronomical units, but Voyager 2 was 134. It should be a little over 134 today, and Voyager 1's furthest away, and then Voyager 2 is 110 AU. So, and as of 2 or 3 years ago, right? I have a website. I gotta find that one. NASA website that said 2013, it had 22 watts on both Voyagers. And I know originally they started out with 24, because I remember Ed Stone, he's project manager. He was project manager when it started, and he still is today, all these years later. It started off at 24, so did it drop from 22 to 6 watts in just 3 years? I don't think so. We'll have to look further into it, but it's a NASA website. Let me drop it.
Yeah, when I said 6 watts, that was a crazy wag guess on my part. You and I may calculate it says running a 19.9 watts today. Back to you, Paul.
Oh, okay. I thought that was news. Okay, very good. There is a decrease in overall power on the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. Every year they tend to drop off 4% or so, 3 or 4%. So they're always cutting back on different things. That's why the cameras don't work anymore. Not that they broke, they just shut them down. As many heaters as they don't need have been shut down. And whatever they need, for detecting, you know, the ions in the atmosphere. And, of course, that's still all working. Plasma detectors or whatever it is, of course, the radio. It will be for at least, they said, 2034 now they're hoping for. Let me drop it. So that's pretty good. We'll have to hang out around 40,000 years, though, before it gets to the nearest star that it's going to. I believe one of the Voyagers, I think it's Voyager 2, will be going to Cirrus. Probably get within around 4. The closest it will get is around 2 or 4 light years. And that's 40,000 years from now, so we've got a long wait. Okay, as far as news for actually last week and this week for the space report, of course you mentioned earlier that Scott Kelly came back from his one-year journey on the ISS. His partner, Kornienko, Mikhail Kornienko. By the way, if you watch the news, a lot of the news stations I find don't even mention him. It looks like we send an American up there like he's all by himself, like there isn't even three people left on the space station. Like the third guy that came down with him, he was up there for almost 6 months. But they're not talking about that. It's amazing what gets lost in the news. But there right now there's three up on board. There were six, and there will be three again after another launch from Kazakhstan coming up in a couple of weeks. You've got an American and two Russians going up on March 18th. And they'll be joining the other three, and you'll have six more on board. And I think at least half the crew are hams, so hopefully they'll be doing more Aries contact with the station. I'm dropping. Okay, of course I wanted to mention the SES-9, Falcon 9 launch that occurred last Friday. It was delayed three different times. Finally, the fourth time they got it off the ground. One day it was problems with loading the cryogenic oxygen, the new system that they're using. They're densifying both liquids, the not only the liquid oxygen, but the RP-1, the fuel, the refined kerosene is also being cooled down substantially from what it used to be. The idea is to make it more dense, and you can put more fuel on board the rocket to, in this case, launch SES-9, which has been waiting for a long time to get to its geosynchronous orbit. It finally got off the ground. This thing was originally supposed to go last fall, but due to the explosion that SpaceX had in June, that put things really behind schedule. So I'm sure they're happy to get that up there. Let me drop it. SES, of course, they're the biggest operator of geosynchronous communication satellites. So they now have another one up there. And so they'll be happy. In fact, they're very happy with SpaceX. They told SpaceX, if you ever get one of those rockets to be reused, we'll be happy to be the first company to put one of our 12,000-pound satellites on top of your rocket to send it up to geosynchronous orbit, just like they did this time. Now, by trying to do that, of course, they need a lot of fuel. SpaceX has a goal of bringing back the first stage, and especially the second stage, probably many years from now on the second stage. But the first stage, they'll be happy if they could do it on a regular basis. They've only done it once. Last December, they brought back the first stage to Cape Canaveral. They landed at Landing Zone 1, they call it now. Originally, it was Launch Complex 13 that they're paying for to operate now. Well, they've always had plans on bringing these first stage back to landing on a, not on a water, but on a drone ship. They have these barges, big as a football field that they use. Right now there's two in operation. It was a total of three that they developed. One of them they returned, but they now have one on the Pacific coast and one on the Atlantic. This one here went out about 400 miles out. That's a lot further, about twice as further than previous attempts. And the reason for that is they were shooting this rocket into geosynchronous orbit. The last flight that they had, they were able to bring it back. That was low Earth orbit. Not low Earth, it was around 400 miles up, but low enough. Big difference between 400 and 23,000 miles. A lot more fuel to do that. And by doing that, they don't have enough power to do what they call a boost back flight all the way back to Florida. So all they could do is have enough fuel for let this thing slow down and then just drop straight down and have enough fuel to do a burn just to land on the drone ship. And it was off center and it didn't work out. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Watched it live last Friday night, 6:35. It took off 8 minutes later. The booster came back, and they have a camera on board, a GoPro camera. And just as it was coming down, you could see the drone ship being lit up by the engines. And then the camera went out right after that, probably due to the explosion. We don't know right now how bad it was. Last time they came back down on a drone ship was in the Pacific Ocean when they launched the Jason 3 rocket to polar orbit for, that was a spacecraft that was going to detect the wave heights. Well, they brought that one back and landed on the deck. Really, it looked good, but then one of the legs broke and it just tipped over and blew, it blew up. And they got most of it back, but unusable. So let me drop it. That's the story on that. Let's see how they do a couple of weeks from now. At the end of March, I believe, March 30th or 31st, unless there's delays, and then it'll go into April due to weather or something. This time there was four different delays. Like I mentioned, the first delay was cryogenics. The second day was, I believe, a ship was out in the water down range. It was in the the forbidden zone, and they caused a delay. By the time they got him out of the way, the cryogenics heated up too much on the rocket, and they just aborted for the day, or scrubbed for the day. So, but finally they get off the ground, and let's see what happens next time. Next time it's a flight to the International Space Station, so that's a low Earth orbit, plenty of fuel. Maybe they'll bring it back to Cape Canaveral again. I think that's what their present plan is, not to the drone ship, and we'll see how that one goes. That's the flight where they're bringing up Beam, that's the Bigelow expansion module that they're going to be putting on to Tranquility. So that's when they attach it, they'll inflate it, the crew will inflate it using air that's stored on the module itself, so they're not going to be hooking up to the space station. They're actually going to have the tanks that inflated attached to the launch. So that's Beam, that's built by Bigelow. I hope that really works out, because that would bode well for the future of
Repeater, timeout.
WS2N. I know I'm getting long here, Dick, but one other launch. I can go on and on, by the way. There's a lot of things happening, but I won't do that. One of the launches I did want to mention is going to be by the European Space Agency. It's not going to be an Ariane rocket by the European Space Agency that takes this thing up, but the Russians contracted to send it rockets, and what they're launching is something called TRACE. TRACE is going to be our orbital spacecraft that will be going around Mars. So Mars will be getting a new tenant very shortly, about eight months. And that orbital spacecraft has attached to it a lander, and the lander is called Schiaparelli. And Schiaparelli, of course, is the named after the astronomer, that one that found all these canals. He didn't call them canals. It's just misrepresented when through the Italian language when it was transferred over to English. But Schiaparelli is the name of the lander, and I'll be landing on Mars. And it's not going to be a rover. It's going to prove their technology, that European Space Agency can do such a thing. If it works out, they will be sending the ExoMars rover. So that they do have a rover planned, and that will be roughly 2 years from now, during the next window opening for Mars. A couple of rockets will be going up at that time, including InSight. That was canceled not too long ago. InSight is the Mars lander that we canceled temporarily. That
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
US to N.
Paul, repeat the last sentence. We lost one sentence of the dropout. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, a lot of things going up in the next couple of years. And one of the things, of course, we didn't even mention will be James Webb Space Telescope, and that's 2018 as well. So three different things happened in 2018. This year we have our own series of things happening, including this summer. We'll be looking for Juno to go into orbit around Jupiter. Second time we're going to do an orbit of that planet. First one was Galileo, and that one is long gone. Back to you, Dick.
Net time complete.
Question for Paul.
You got it, John.
Paul, one thing I haven't heard you mention, I might have missed it. These barges that they send out, are they powered? How do they maintain station to be where they're going to be when the rocket comes down? That'd be interesting. I'd like to hear about that if you got it.
Yeah, they're powered. And when they're near shore, I know they're towed. They have a ship that goes with it too. Looks like a pretty large ship, and naturally they have a good sized crew on there, and that's where everybody is, all the people are, when these things land. So this barge is roughly the size of a football field, and it's got four engines in each corner, at least four engines to keep it steady, not only left and right, but up and down, and all kinds of GPS equipment on board to let the booster know where it is. So that's how they do it. And I think they said it could stay within 1 foot of elevation, even in pretty rough seas. So something to do with old oil platform rigs. Something to do with that industry, and he took them over. He actually rents them and then builds them to his specifications and uses them. That's what happened on the first one. He wanted to do more, and he got another barge, and he just sent that one back to some Louisiana company that rents these things out to him. And then he took out a third one, so that's why there's two left. The other one he sent back. Back to you, John.
Well, very good. Very good, Paul. So they have steering vanes on them, I guess, like some of the cruise ships have, to maintain that position, but they control elevation, too. Fantastic. Okay, back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. Thank you.
First of all, let's see if we have other people listening that want to ask a question to Paul right now on the subject of space. Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2RYY.
You got it, Joe. Fire away.
Good evening, Paul. Recently this week, I heard something about some kids in, I guess around the Virginia area, where that's where they had it launched from, had constructed this satellite called the Cube Satellite. And it's apparently been brought up to the space station. It's going to be deployed from there. And this thing is supposed to be able to take pictures at some sort of regular time interval once they release the thing. But the curious thing about it was, it's supposed to be receivable on amateur radio frequencies. Have you heard anything about this? Back to you. I know there's quite a few CubeSats that have been done by colleges, and a lot of them are just kind of like transmitted. They'll transmit on the amateur frequencies. So that might be one of them. Probably 18 or 20, I think, went up on the last Cygnus spacecraft, the one that was launched by Orbital by from Florida on the Atlas V. And on that cargo craft, they had about, I think, 18 to 20 of these CubeSats. Each CubeSat is about 4x4x4, and each one has a different purpose, but by a different college or a different, it could be a different country. And I think three or four times a year, they open up the hatch. There's a small airlock located in the Japanese unit, the Kaibo module. It's actually one of the biggest modules up there. They'll launch it out of that airlock. And I thought they just did one, so it might have already been released. Back to you. Okay, what is the source of power on these Cube satellites, and how do they steer these things to be able to do something with them if they are camera equipped? Back to you. Yeah, I know some of them don't have cameras. Some of them, maybe the one that you're talking about does, but some of them, the ones I heard about, really don't. They use for they're almost like the Dove satellites, where they transmit, pick up signals. They can go to Aries, AMSAT group, and they'll have a whole list of any CubeSats with frequencies. They're all solar panel. There's no actually they have batteries to keep the charge up. They're all solar panels. All six sides. But a couple planned. They don't even know who's going to build it, and they're sending them on the SLS on the first launch to the moon. That thing goes up, and that'll be the end of 2018 as well. So that's a breadboard one. That's I think the size of three CubeSats. So they're all about the same. Back to you, John. Do you know what part of the amateur band these devices are transmitting in, and what kind of modulation schemes you use to be able to receive the information from there if they are indeed sending pictures? Do you know anything about that? I don't know if any's sending pictures yet. That's going to be interesting, because again, I don't know how they stabilize them. So and the antennas do pop out of the, they open up like, look like switchblades to me. One of the sides. And the frequencies, they're listed out here. I'm not sure if it's 70 centimeters. Some of them might use 2 meters, or maybe higher. But I don't know yet. Haven't investigated the frequencies. Okay, that's all I have for questions for this week on this. I just happened to see a clip on the news in the morning a couple of days ago. I thought it was kind of interesting that they brought the thing up like that. And yeah, it does look like a small cube, and it looked like with high school kids that built it someplace from the United States.
Paul, you probably said it, and I got called away for a minute. What is the source of the power for the CubeSat?